So, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy New Year.
Yes.
So, you had a relaxing Christmas break? Why? Because you worked too hard or
too much
just too busy partying?
Too much project.
Yeah,
partying and too much.
Okay, well, you know, there are so many people who don't have work to do that should feel happy. Mm. So, if you recall what we did last time, we were talking about what?
Share the details.
Yes, share the details. And so I did the first part of this last time where I talked about a number of tools that have been developed over the years for text editing, synchronous, asynchronous, synchronous or real time, for text or for graphics with some features. And then I think I finished more or less saying, well, there are some tools today, Google Docs on the web, for programming there's something with a weird name called Samita Edit, and even Microsoft Office now has their Office applications that are in the cloud and that can work for collaboration. But in all these cases, everybody has to use the same application to be able to share things. A lot of them tend to be cloud-based, which means you don't know really who owns your documents, where they are, and what happens to them. They rely on you having network access. Although I know Google, for example, allows you to work offline and try to reconcile things when you get online. And they also are all very strict, sort of have a single level of coupling, and you cannot control that. And when you work collaboratively, sometimes you want to have pure WYSIWYS. You want to see exactly the same thing, the same part of the document, each other's cursors and things like this. And sometimes we want to do loose coupling where we do work on the same document, but we're each in our corner and we don't want to be bothered by what the other is doing. And if you think of synchronous versus asynchronous, you could also, instead of making it two different categories, say, well, you know, this is on the same spectrum of being very tightly coupled or very loosely coupled, where you edit things in your corner and at some point you make it available to me, which is what happens essentially through version-based systems, especially for people who develop code, for example. But there's no reason these things should be done by different tools differently, because when we work, we don't want to shift tool when we shift the type of activity that we have. It would be better if this were integrated in the same context. So my point here was to say these shared editors have existed for a long time, but what we have today is still very primitive compared to what I think we could build. So, unless you have any questions about this part of the class from last time, I'm going to move now to how these things are actually implemented. So, class today is going to be more computer science oriented. We're going to go under the hood and see how these things work. And maybe understand a little bit why there's no system today that does everything perfectly, because it is difficult. So, if you look at the literature on people who have worked on the implementation of shared editors or this type of groupware, you find two broad categories. One is called collaboration transparent systems, the other collaboration aware systems. So, in the first category, the idea is we have a bunch of applications out there that already exist. They are a single user. But can we make them multi-user without having to rewrite completely, you know, Microsoft Office or Photoshop or any of these big applications? Now, when you do this, a there's always two sides to an interaction, to an interactive system. There's a side of the display, usually a visual display, and there's a side of input. Now, on the side of display, it's, if you want to do strict WYSIWYS, it's fairly easy. There are a number of techniques. I don't know if you know VNC, but it's a very well-known technique for sharing pixels. So it takes your screen, or I guess the part of your screen or window, and gets pixels out of them and copies them over the network and shows them somewhere else. So if you do this, it's very easy to share the display of an application. But of course, you can only share what the primary user is seeing. So you are limited to the strict view sharing that we talked about when we looked at the various ways to relax WYSIWYS. So you can do this at the level of this entire screen. You can do this at the level of the window. But you will be limited to this notion of everybody sees the same thing. Now, the next thing is there is the input side of things. Who gets to control the interaction? Now, these applications have been designed with the idea that there's one user at a time. So you could imagine having everybody provide input together, but it will probably do things that the application didn't anticipate. Because if I start clicking my mouse button and dragging something, and you do the same, the system will receive one mouse down, mouse move, another mouse down, and it doesn't expect to have the second mouse down once it's already received one, and the mouse up has not happened. So applications will get confused if you send them input from everyone. So you end up having to do some form of turn-taking where someone has the control of the whole application and the others watch. And then there are several strategies you can imagine. One is to have a button to say, well, I want to take the floor. The person who has the floor can say, well, I'm done now, whoever wants to take it. Or you can have a moderator who decides who gets to interact. Or you can have something more implicit where, you know, if you do nothing, you lose the floor. But the first person clicks, so gets the floor until they don't do anything for a few seconds and things like this. So the advantage of this approach is that, you know, of course, you don't have to rewrite entire applications. You can use existing applications. Of course, the drawback is that it's limited to a particular type of groupware, which is really strict WYSIWYS real-time groupware with term-taking as input. So the more interesting cellular systems are the collaboration-aware system. Now, why don't be misled by these terms, because to me they're a little bit weird. Usually when you use the word transparent in computer science, it's a good thing. You want things to be transparent. Transparent to the network, transparent to various things. I mean, here the word collaboration transparent means that the application does not need to know that it is being executed in a collaborative environment. However, this transparency to the collaboration is also a limitation. On the other hand, when we say collaboration aware here, we mean that the application is designed to take advantage and to implement some collaboration features. So the word may be a little bit misleading. So collaboration aware systems are systems that are designed from the start for collaborative work. And essentially when you start thinking of doing this kind of things, you run into problems that have to do with distributed systems. Well, there is a category of groupware that I actually didn't talk about. I don't think I did. It's called single display groupware. It's oftentimes abbreviated SDG. And SDG is the idea that you have one display, single display, as it says, and on that display, or on the computer attached to the display, you connect many input devices. So this is stuff that has been done, for example, for education purposes in schools. You do a drawing tool and you plug as many mice as you have kids in the room, and they each get to play with their own mouse. So this is a case where you have a collaborative system, but it is using a single computer. It has some applications, but it's not a very widespread kind of tool, so I'm not going to say more about it. If you Google for this, we'll find a couple of papers about this. So in the vast majority of the cases, your groupware system is going to be a distributed computer system, with each user typically having their own computer, and in the middle of all that there is at least a network, and usually one, sometimes several servers. And so if you think of editing a shared document, one way to do this is that each user will have a copy of the document, and then you have to build a system that will make it look like it's the same document for everyone. So that if one person changes something, the changes to be broadcast to the others, and they have to make that same change in the document, so it looks like we're all editing the same shared document. So that's a problem well known in distributed systems, called managing the consistency of distributed copies. It's also well known in databases, when you have distributed databases, and it's a complex problem. The second issue is robustness. We don't want that I have to stop working because somewhere else on the other side of the world has a network connection that has fallen down and it puts everything down. So there are several levels to robustness. Of course, if the system is using a central server and that server goes down, well, probably things are not going to work well. However, what we want is, as much as possible, each user to be able to keep working, irrespective of the problems that other users may have. So a good example of this is Google Docs. Although Google Docs is actually not really using the distributed copies model, because everything is happening on their servers, and the part that is on your computer is a browser which is dumb and does not know very much about what is being shared. So we're going to focus on this, and in particular on the notion of this consistency and robustness of multiple copies of a document. So before we get there, I realize there is a whole bunch of vocabulary that is associated with CSCW in general, groupware in particular, and shared editing in particular, that people tend to use, and you've seen in literature, and it never gets defined. So I try to put a list here. It's probably, certainly not exhaustive, but it's a number of terms you will find a lot if you look at the literature in this area. First thing is, usually we don't talk about users, we talk about participants. Why is that? I'm not sure. It's a tradition. Second, there is a notion of session. You don't tend to use the word session for traditional HCI applications. In groupware, there's a notion of a session which goes with the notion of invitation. So if we're going to work together, we are creating a session, and then people are invited to join the session. Floor control, I already mentioned that, is the policy for managing input from multiple users. So turn taking is one example of floor control, where one person can talk or interact at a time, which was what we had in the collaboration transparent applications I talked about. When everybody can interact all the time without any limitation, we tend to call this open floor. Another term that's used is the notion of telepointer. The idea is that you can see what the other users are doing, and the primary thing they are doing is to move their cursor around. So a telepointer is a visualization on your screen of the cursor of the other users.
But like in the
I'm I'm sorry?
Like
exactly. So in another someone we saw this video clip I showed, this he called it the bug. And that was exactly that. Now a cursor can be like in this example, the cursor, the mouse cursor itself. If you think of Google Doc, you don't see the mouse cursor of the other users, but you see their text cursor. And the text cursor has a little label and the color, so you know whose cursor it is. So the telepointer is not necessarily the mouse cursor. It can be so the text cursor in that case, or if you were doing other types of documents, maybe something appropriate, so you know where the other are and what they are doing. So these are terms I put in this first category because they are more user-oriented. The second category here is more for the developer. So we talked about coupling many times. I tried to give a definition here that the level of coupling is how local actions are tied to remote actions. So when I do something and the same action has to be replicated, duplicated, copied at the other user's computers, when and how does this happen? Does this happen immediately, in which case I get real-time groupware? Does it happen sometime later? Does it happen automatically? Do I have to push the changes like I do with a version control system? Does it happen exactly the same or not? We saw in group design that when I was moving an object, I could see all the incremental moves, but the others would only see the final position of the object. So there's a lot of stuff that goes under coupling here. Now, one important thing about groupware is the performance. We're going to have a system that uses a network to tie together all the users. And there are two things that are important here. One is usually called response time. It's the time it takes for an action to be executed locally. So I type an A in my shared text editor. How long does it take for this A to appear on my screen? Now, we are used to have short response time. So I want this to happen as quickly as possible. Now, if for this A to appear on my screen, I have to go talk to a server, do some kind of complex algorithm there to decide what's going on, and then wait for the server to send the information back, say, oh, by the way, there is an A there, it's probably not going to be as good, as short a response time that if the local copy can say, well, here's an A, and then I will tell the others and we'll see what happens. So that's why we distinguish between response time and notification time, which is the time it takes for an action to be executed remotely on the other users. So the time it takes between I type an A and you see an A. And usually the type of compromise you want to make in shared editing is to optimize for response time, even if it costs you a bit of notification time. In general, it's better to give the local user immediate feedback, even if it means the other users will have to wait a little bit more. And by a little bit, I say, you know, maybe a second. And that's, of course, because of the interaction loops that we talked about in the intro class, where, you know, we're used for things to happen under a tenth of a second. If it's under a tenth of a second, we see it as immediate. If it takes more than a tenth of a second, we see a delay, a lag, and that's problematic. Now, I'm saying this as a general rule. It's not always true. If you're going to do a shared editor for people to play music together, well, it's going to be a little harder because you don't want you know, synchronization is very important in music, so if you delay the notification time too much, people won't be able to really play together. Okay, replication and robustness. So The notion of replication is the idea that, in particular, to optimize for response time, you want to put more stuff happening near the user, so at the user's computer, instead of on a central server where you have to go, you know, run loops all the time. So if you want stuff to happen on everybody's computer, you need to replicate the documents, the data structure, the processing happening at, and that's called replication. And of course, we want this to be done transparently so that the user doesn't have to know how it works. Under robustness, as I said before, is, well, in general, is what happens when something breaks in the system. It tends to be seen here from the perspective of one user. How does someone else's problem affect my use of the system? So, as I said, this is, you know, some of the vocabulary you'll see in papers about this topic, and I'm sure there is more. And I'll have to extend the list at some point. So, if we look at how to implement these systems, and I said, you know, these are distributed systems, so in a sense, it's not new. People have been dealing with distributed systems for a long time. There are some similarities with the way operating systems are designed. Now, operating systems are, if you think of Unix or all the variants, including Linux, that are around, all these are multi-user systems. They allow multiple users to be logged in simultaneously on the same machine and to do things and to manage shared resources. Now, you guys grew up with personal computers. Have you ever worked on a mainframe? No? Do you know what a mainframe is? What it looks like? Well, when I started, there was no personal computer. And so what we did is we went to a room. There were a bunch of terminals that were hooked up to one computer for the whole lab or department through serial lines, and the computer was a dumb terminal. I don't know if you've ever heard of VT100 terminals, but it's these terminals, they have 25 lines of 80 characters, and that's all you got. And all it does is you type a character, it goes to the mainframe, and then the mainframe can send characters back, and they display on your screen. So, and that's why, in fact, originally we designed operating systems. In the very, very early days, one person could use the computer at a time. And of course, because humans are slower than, or became slower, or rather because computers became faster than humans, although interestingly, it took a while. For a number of years, there were human computers that were able to do computations faster than the computers. And the fastest one we're doing with the what's called the Chinese boolean abacus, yeah. You know, the thing where you move little balls and rings. And for, you know, until the 50s, there were competitions to see who was faster between the human and the computer. So it took a while for computers to get faster than humans. But when that happened, people realized it's inefficient to have a human sitting in front of a huge computer, spending a lot of time trying to program and debug and do things when the computer could do other things. And that's how operating systems were originally designed, to allow sharing of one big computing resource among several computers. And until the 70s and well into the 80s and even 90s, in places like university labs, industry, everywhere people were using computers, what you had is dumb terminals on the tables hooked up to one big central computer. Until, I guess, we didn't have individual workstations, so expensive personal computers. At LRI, for example, until, I believe, the 90s. And so, that's why operating systems have to manage the notion of several users working together and sharing resources, not only computing resources, but printers and things like this. Now, the thing is, in those cases, and it's the same thing for databases, the notion of having one database shared by multiple users, and that was done very early on for, you know, things like reservation systems for airlines or things like this. The issue was, we have a bunch of users, we want to make them think the computer or the database is for you, for use by them and only them. So the goal was to be transparent in that sense, in that the users should not be aware that there are other users sharing that resource. And so because of this, a number of solutions that were created for operating systems, and which work very well, were not really adapted to groupware, where we want users to know that they're working with others, and in fact, they do know that they're working with others, so the system should support that and take advantage of that. So we saw these things called, you know, view congruence, whether people want to see exactly the same thing or not, the notion of feed-through, telling other users what I am doing. There's also issues when you have this notion of shared documents of latecomers. Someone who's arriving late in the session should be put up to date with the rest of the group. So if you are in a chat system, if you arrive, you want to see maybe not the whole conversation, but what's happened recently, and things like this. So while we can build systems that take advantage of stuff that's been done and that's already existing in operating systems, there are some specific needs for groupware that are not covered by these existing tools. Oh, another one of these. Yeah. Oh. Some French has crept in here. I still don't know why these slides don't come up all at once. Anyway, so you remember this diagram? Okay, just checking. So this is a traditional interactive system diagram. User inputs commands into the system, he has some feedback while he's or she is inputting the command. The command translates into operations on a set of objects, and then the results of these operations are fed back to the user as responses. Now, this works well when you have one user and one system. If I have multiple users, essentially I have several of these operating on the same objects, to be vague. Now, in terms of not what the user sees, but in terms of how you build the system, there are typically three types of software architectures for this kind of thing. One is the easiest and most obvious one, is called a centralized architecture. So in a centralized architecture, you have one server, and then all the users have a program on their computer that is very dumb, and everything is done through the server. So every time you interact, it's the server that does the work and sends the responses. So with this architecture, the cut is here. All of this is on the server, and some of this is on the user terminal. Now the advantage of this is it's simple. It's simple to build because it's not different from what we do in operating systems. Because what it gives you is a serialization of user actions. So if this user does something and this one does something, it doesn't matter really if they do it exactly at the same time, one before or after the other. The server will deal with one and then with the other. In whatever order, it will decide that this one was the first one and this one was the second one, and then it will send the results to everyone, and so things get synchronized just because of this round-robin type of operation. So that's why it's simple, but it has two problems. The first one, of course, is that everything goes to the server,
So it's less efficient than if processing could be done locally. So the response time is not going to be as good. In fact, in this type of system, by definition, the response time equals notification time. And second, it's brittle. It's brittle in the sense that, well, if one user goes down, it doesn't hurt, but if the server goes down, everybody is in trouble. So the next idea is to go to what's called a replicated architecture. And in a replicated architecture, everything happens on the user's computers, and they talk to each other. So you have a complete communication graph, so that when one user issues an action here, like typing A, it sends this to everyone else. And then you need to have a magic piece of algorithm that makes sure that everything happens in a consistent way. Because if this one types A, this one types B, and sends it to the others, and those happen close enough in time, this guy may receive A and then B, but this one may receive B then A. So you see the problem in that this person types A, so presumably it inserts A immediately, and the B is going to arrive later. This one is going to type B, the B is going to get inserted immediately, the A is going to arrive later. And these two, well, it depends. You know, the network may be faster or something. And so you end up with two guys have AB and two guys have BA. So it's not really a shared document anymore. So the advantage is that you have good response time because you can do this interaction loop locally for the user. And then it's here at the level of operations and objects that you send things to other copies, to other replicas, and the magic happens. So in this case, the cut is here, where all of this is on the user terminal. Now, from distributed systems, we know that doing things without any kind of centralized server is really hard. It's possible, but it's really hard. So in most cases, the best solution is a hybrid solution, where mostly the architecture is replicated, but there may be some centralized function. So if you want to store the document somewhere so that, you know, someone can leave the session, come back, and usually you're going to have a central server that's holding the documents, and where you connect the first time to see who's there and what's what. And then once you've sort of retrieve the session information, then you can go into the replicated mode where things are distributed and you get the advantages of this. Now, the advantages of replication, of pure replication, is that since there is no central server, if anything goes wrong, nobody gets hurt, except the person who gets disconnected. But so that's the advantage, of course, of the in addition to the response notification. But again, it is complex, and what I'm going to talk about is how in a replicated architecture you manage the situation I illustrated here, which is called the conflict. So what I briefly illustrated here is a conflict in that some of the sites will see operations in one order, other sites in a different order, and we still want to end up with the same or similar consistent state. So it's a general problem of consistency of distributed data. As I said, each site generates events and sends them to the other site. And each site must execute those events so that the result is consistent across sites. And essentially you'll find two classes of algorithms, the pessimistic ones and the optimistic ones. why they're called like this, because in a pessimistic algorithm, you assume things are going to go wrong. And you take measures so they don't. So pessimistic algorithms are the ones used, and they were developed originally typically for distributed databases. And it's the notion of lock, it's the notion of transaction, and I'm sure you've heard of that before. Yes? Good memories, locking and transactions in database systems. Cool stuff. The idea is we don't want things to go back, to go bad. So we said, before I do anything, I'm going to reserve the right to do it so that nobody else can get the same access. That's the locking part. And then I will make sure that either my whole operation is going to occur or nothing is going to occur. This is the atomic aspect of transactions. The transactions either completes or everything is as if it didn't happen. Now, if you think of this in the context here of simple shared text editor, it means that, you know, when you type an A, before you can do anything, you have to tell everybody else, hey, I'm going to type something, don't move. During this time, nobody else can do anything. I mean, I assume they could type and you could put that in buffer, but... and then when you get the log, you say, okay, I'm inserting the A, and now I'm done, and you unlock, and then someone else says, oh, it's my turn. Typically, what you can have with this is starvation. Some people may say, but they're always, you know, taken over by someone else. And it's going to be slow for everyone. So that's why we don't like pessimistic algorithms. Yeah.
Yes.
Question?
Do we use a kind that develops some functional
algorithms
to develop algorithms?
Yes.
Apart from revealing that there are other users, is there any more difficulty in group-one systems, that it's something more than what we do already from the operating system?
Well, the problem is that we don't have the same requirements. So in the shared system, we work together, and the reason the optimistic algorithms I'm going to talk about work is because people are aware of what the others are doing, so they're less likely to create conflicts. So in a database system, if you think of, I don't know, a rental car company or an airline with a central reservation system, with people all around the world making reservations, they don't know who else is making reservation. And when you're starting to make reservation from, you know, a website, you don't want the last minute that it says, oh, someone else
could
see. It
sounds easier than more difficult. That's what I understand.
Well,
yeah.
This is much easier. Pessimistic approach is much easier. Yeah. First, it's been, you know, developed for a long time, so a lot of experience with that. And it's safer because things either work or don't happen. So you're never in this in-between that we will see with optimistic algorithms where things seem like they're going right, and then suddenly later you learn that no, and you have to repair things. So it is easier. But what we want is to make the user experience the priority. And the user experience is that when I type something in the Google Doc, I want it to show up right now. And if this, the rest of what the others are doing is delayed, or it's not the priority. So, when the first group-aware systems were developed, and in fact, interestingly, this was work by Steve Hallis and others, who were coming from databases, who knew a lot about this locking and transaction approach. But they started developing shared editors. I'm sure they started to do it with pessimistic algorithms, and when they tried to use it, they realized it was not a good user experience. And so they are the ones who developed the first optimistic algorithms, saying, well, let's assume things go well, and then let's make it so we can detect when they go wrong, and let's see if we can fix it. And in general, the approach to do this is to say, well, let's do operations locally first. and let the others know what we did. And the others will receive information saying what happened. And let's put enough information in those events so everybody has a way to execute things in the same order. And if I receive an event that says, Paul inserted a bee, 10 minutes ago, well, what I could do is undo everything that happened for the past 10 minutes, insert the bee, and then redo everything that happened. Transparently, so the user wouldn't see it. But essentially, all these algorithms are based on the form, an optimized form of this undo redo. So the basic model is every event that you send has a timestamp. It occurred at this clock. And let's assume just for now there's a universal clock, which we know we cannot build, but let's assume it's there. Because there is this clock, this timestamp in the message, I know when it happened. So when I receive those messages, even if they arrive out of order, I can, if a message arrives late, I can undo the more recent ones, execute the one in the right sequence, and then re-execute the new ones. And this way, everything that happens can be executed immediately, and for things that happen late, I can undo and redo the sequence, so I repair, if you want to see it this way, the damage that was done by the fact that I didn't receive the message in time. Does this make sense? Because we're going to go into deeper details there, but I want you to have a general sense of how this works. Okay? So, the fact of the matter is, in real life, people tend to stay away of conflicts. I don't know if you've used the Google Docs and shared where people edit things really simultaneously. I mean, if you see a piece of the text moving, you're not going to go there, put your cursor there, and start doing things at the same time. You're likely to stay away, wait until it comes down or something, or use the chat channel to say, well, what are you doing? Or so, because there is this collaborative aspect, people tend to avoid conflicts. So that's why the optimistic approach works. It's because conflicts are rare. If you were to use these algorithms with a large number of conflicts, they would be very inefficient. Now, the thing is, conflicts are rare, but they occur. And when they occur, you don't want the system to get broken. You certainly don't want it to crash. You don't want things to be inconsistent and things like this. So you still need to make it work with conflicts, but you assume they will be rare. So I'll talk about two approaches. One is the one that was developed originally for the Grove editor by these people from databases. It's called operational transformation. And the other one is, in fact, simpler and something we, among other people, we work on that approach, and this is the optimized undo redo. Okay, so now things are getting more serious. So, I said if we had a global clock that could give everyone a consistent time, things would be fairly easy because I could give a timestamp to every event and have a strict order of all the events. Well, the thing is that this is making the assumption that if an event occurs after another one, there is a causality link between the first one and the second event. And a lot of things in those distributed algorithms that deal with the consistency of replicated copies have to do with this notion of causality. Because if there is a causality relationship between event A and event B, I want to be sure I execute A before B. If A and B are independent, then the order in which I execute them should not matter. So, if A happened before B, then A must be executed before B. Because A may have influenced the state of the world when B was executed. So, Mr. Lamport, Leslie Lamport, invented, this is very old, I think in the 70s, something called logical clocks. He said, well, okay, we cannot have a universal clock, but let's try to build the next best thing. So, what he built was logical clock, and they are logical clocks because the time they count is not in seconds or minutes. It's in terms of events. Every time a new event occurs, I increment the clock by one, the counter. So it's really a counter. We call it a clock, but it's really a counter. Now, I'm sure a number of you have heard that in some classes, no? Lamport clocks? Yeah.
It's Mathem clocks.
I'm sorry?
The Mathem vector.
Yeah, so clock vectors, yeah. That's a complex version of this. I'm only doing the simple stuff. So each side has a counter, and it's their clock. Now, every time I do something locally and send an event, I increment the counter, and I send that counter with my event. And it's called a timestamp. Now, when I receive an event, and this event has a timestamp t, I said, well, if t is after my local clock, it would mean that this event occurred in the future. That's weird. So I'm going to update my local clock to t plus 1. It just means that, you know, I've been doing nothing, stuff has been happening in other places, and they're telling me about it, so their clock has moved on, so I need to adjust to that. Like that.
Sorry.
With this extremely simple rule, I can define a partial order of events. And even better, I can turn it into a global order of events that is going to be the same for everyone. So I get what I was looking for, which is this universal clock. Except it's not universal time, but it's numbers. So here it goes. For this to work, I need to have also each side to have a unique number. Now there's many ways, very well known in the distributed systems literature, to, you know, in a distributed system make sure everyone has a unique number. You can even do things using an IP address if you want. So assume each side has a unique number S1, S2. So if I receive an event, and of course, when I send an event, I said, this is what happened, this is my timestamp, and this is my site number. So I send these three things. So when I receive an event that is stamped with T1 and S1, and I receive another event, T2 and S2, or it can be one of the events I generated, I can say safely that T1 S1 was before T2 S2, if either T1 is strictly lower than T2, or if they were equal, then S1 is smaller than S2. Now the thing with the system is, it may happen that two sides have the same logical clock, and they will send an event to each other, to everybody else, with the same timestamp. Now, when they will receive the one from the other, they will do the update here. But the two things may happen simultaneously from the perspective of this counting system. So we know by construction that if the timestamps are different, I can use the order of the timestamps. And then if they are equal, things happen in parallel. So by definition, there cannot be a causal relationship between those two things. You know, I tap A and you tap B at the same time. You know, they cannot be one influencing the other. But if I type A, you see my A, and then you type B, I have to assume that it was maybe a consequence of my event. So when things are simultaneous, well, we decide on an arbitrary order that is going to be the same for everyone using these unique site numbers. So with the simple logical blocks from Mr. Lamport, we now have a way to give complete order, a global order on all events in the system.
And what if they are, we have a conflict? I mean, if we do the same thing
with
the same.
So, okay, the thing is, let's assume, you know, we both have our text cursor here, and we type two letters exactly at the same time. What is supposed to happen? Should be AB or BA? Well, the point is, it doesn't really matter. What matters is that everybody makes the same decision, right? So if my site number happens to be higher than yours, then yours will be inserted first and mine second. But because this is the same rule for everyone, everyone will decide that you win over me. And so the result will be the same.
But if it's not a text and it's a checkbox, for example,
yes.
Only one can decide yes or no, you cannot have two
answers. Oh, if you have a checkbox and two people click at the same time?
And then you say no and I say yes.
Well, on the checkbox it's not exactly that. On the checkbox you click.
Yeah.
They say I click this. What will happen if we both click at exactly the same time is that we cancel each other. Now, you may want to say, well, you know, if someone has clicked, you may want to detect this kind of situation, saying, well, it was, in fact, a simultaneous action, and maybe I want to notify the users that something weird happened there. The point here is that this allows us to detect these kind of things. And it's true that I could take advantage that if the timestamp was the same, these events were quote simultaneous and treat that special. This, you know, this is not what systems do in general, but it is possible. So the whole point of this is that in a distributed systems like this, it allows you to do the same thing that a centralized system does, which is to order things in a consistent way. And so this is what we use in the simple algorithms, which are the undo redo algorithms. So let's assume the events we're sending are an operation. You remember my diagram, operation over objects. So I want to do an operation over an object, like inserting a character at position X, a timestamp, and a site number. So at each replica, the system is very simple. I have a local operation, I execute it locally, and I send an event to everyone else. I receive an operation. Oh, other thing I do is I store it in a queue to have a local history of what happened. When I receive an event, I look at that queue. If it's more recent than everything else, that's fine. I just execute it, I'm done. If it's older, well, I go back in my queue, I undo all the operations, I execute the one that arrived late, and then I re-execute all the ones that I just undid. Now, I do this, you know, without the user see all the undo redo operations, so it will just happen as one thing. No, you don't. You make it so you don't see the changes on the screen. And so that's really simple and it works. The only condition is that every operation you have must have an inverse operation. You must be able to undo everything. Okay, problem with that. First problem, you need a history buffer that may be as long as the whole session. Is it a problem or not? I'm not sure. You can actually reduce the size of the history buffer by using what's called a heartbeat. Because in fact, there is the question, well, each site is going to send events in their order. So if you assume that the network is not losing things, if you receive something from a site, you know that we will, you know, again, depends on your transport, on your network. But if you're using TCP/IP to make things simple, you know that you will never receive something that is older from that site. Right? So you can keep a vector of the timestamps of the most recent thing you received from each of the sites. And you know that you can remove from your history buffer everything that is older than that, because you will never have to undo beyond that point. Now the problem with that is that if among the users you have one who's sitting there doing nothing, is not sending event, and so you don't have news from that site, so you won't be able to clear your history buffer, because you don't know, maybe, you know, in 10 years, it will send an event from 10 years before, and you'll have to undo 10 years of operation. So with a heartbeat, what you do is every site, even if it's doing nothing, every 1 second, 10 seconds, depends, sends an event like this with an empty operation. But it's just an I'm alive. Now this is also very useful because it allows each site to also know if the other sites are alive. And, you know, if you look at the Skype or the chat systems that tell you who's online and all that, well, they tell you the person went offline if, for example, the network goes down because it's losing the heartbeat. So that's how it works. But in our case here, these heartbeat messages also have the effect that they allow you to limit the size of the history buffer. So this is very efficient. This is very simple. It's not very efficient because the undo redo can be expensive.
Yeah, and what if you cannot redo a version? The out of sync command was a delete command, and you can't redo what you have done on this subject because it doesn't exist anymore. So what will happen in this case?
Well, the thing is that if the effect of this is that you have transient inconsistent state. So, if someone else has deleted a character and the message says delete character at position 10, and there was a message for inserting a character at position 8 before that, but you haven't received it yet, you're going to delete the wrong character the first time. And then, when you undo, insert the character and redo, it will delete the right character. So there will be times where things are not the way they should be, which is a weakness of this algorithm. So it is simple, but you have transient inconsistent states.
Okay, for characters, but if we talk about pictures or diagrams, when another user deletes the object, you will lose all your choice.
Yes.
Okay, but that,
well, again, if I have received events that say, well, change this color, this object to red, and then I receive an event that happens earlier that says delete that object, I'm going to do my undo operation, so I'm undoing the color red operation, then I delete the object, then I redo, and when I get to color red that object, I realize that object does not exist, so I don't do anything, I skip it. So, yeah, so it means that object IDs have to be unique, and, I mean, it gets a little bit messy, even with a simple algorithm. So, what we did, and that was a while ago, with a former student of mine, was to say, well, let's optimize this so we minimize the number of undo redo. As we were just saying, our goal is to have a system that is consistent
when it is another word used in this literature, quiescent. Quiescent means it's like quiet. It means all the messages that have been sent have been received and processed. There's nothing floating in the network. So if we do a lot of work together all at the same time, and then we stop, then all the messages will arrive, be processed, and things will quiet down. And when the system is in that state where nothing is in transit, then we want everybody to see the same thing. While we're all doing things at the same time, we may all see something slightly different. But when it quiets down, it will converge to the same state. So we use network timestamps for total ordering. We use undo redo when a message arrives out of order. However, we optimize the undo redo. So it's better to illustrate this with examples. So what we observed in that is that in tools, especially drawing tools, operations tend to either commute or mask each other. So let's say I have a rectangle here, and I have two users. One is going to change it to an ellipse, and the other is going to turn it yellow or orange. And if these arrive at the other side in the reverse order, the object will be first turned orange and then turned to an ellipse. What you see, the result is the same. The intermediary state is different, but the result is the same. So in this case, I don't have to do the undo redo. And typically, operations that operate on different aspects of an object, if one operates on the shape, the other on the color, if one were to change the color, the other the thickness, and things like this, if you operate on independent aspects of the object, these operations commute. You can execute them in any order, the result is the same. So when we do our undo redo thing, if we run into operations that commute with the one I'm trying to insert earlier in time, I don't need to go that far back. Second case is masking. And this is what happens when you have operations that operate on the same attributes of the object. So here, one user is changing the object to blue, the other to orange. So A is going to change first to blue, then to orange, the other first to orange, then to blue. Now in this case, we get not only a different intermediate state, but different final state. That's not good. I need to resolve that. Well, the idea is that my total order here will tell me, well, it was A, then B. Even though, for all we know, it happened at the same time, we will have everybody make the assumption that it was A, then B. So the final state is this one. So, if I have two operations that mask each other, that means the effect of one is masking the effect of the other, I can ignore the older one. So at this side, I will receive B, then I will receive A, and I will go through my history buffer. I said, but I received a more recent operation. And this one that I'm trying to insert was masked by this more recent one. So it's even better because I can just ignore it. I just discard it. And so, I have to go back to this slide here. So when we do the undo redo sequence, we look at which operations commute with the one we're trying to insert, which operation masks the one we're trying to insert. If we run into masking one, we're done. As long as we're running into commuting ones, we're done as well, because we know we can execute now, we don't have to do the undo. And so in the case of group design, which is this group editing tool I showed last time, We made it so that every operation was, every pair of operations was either commuting or masking. Now, we're not saying this is always possible, so you need to have this history buffer, etc., for cases where it's neither commuting or masking, but you can design your set of operations so that at least a lot of the time it's going to be in one of these two cases. And then if that happens, then you just execute your operation or you just discard it and you're done. You don't have to do the undo read. Yes?
And we assume every time we want to compare and find the conflict and do all that thing, it's always better than to just undo and redo?
Well, comparing is going to go a lot faster than undoing, because undoing is... It really depends. I mean, in group design, we had a fairly simple type of drawing tool. If you have a drawing tool that is a more complicated data structure, it may be more complicated. But in general, undo and redo is quite expensive. So if you can avoid it, it's best. You know, there's no absolute rule. You can always find a weird application where things are different. But for this class of tools, where you're sharing documents made of a fairly complex data structure, it works well. So that works well for situations where you can have a lot of operations that either commute or mask each other. Now let's look at the operational transform approach. Now this was developed in the context of concurrent text editing. Now, text editing in a sense is harder than this graphical editing, because if your operation are insert a character or delete a character at position X in the text, this position X will change when others insert or delete things before it. Whereas when I'm dealing with graphical objects, they each have a unique ID and they're independent of each other. Unless I have, say, a group containing other objects where I can have some dependencies. But even in that case, it's not as bad as text. So text is a really messy situation because of this. So here's a typical problem that you can imagine in a system like Google Docs if it didn't have any kind of conflict resolution. So we have this initial situation. My cursor is before the W, yours is after. I am going to insert an M. So I have an M and my cursor is next. But if my cursor is described by index in the text, your cursor will have moved before the W. And so what you're doing on your side is your cursor is there, you're deleting the W, so you delete, W disappears. And so we have an inconsistent state, but that's okay because the system is not quiescent yet. We haven't handled all the events. Now, I receive your thing that says receives, delete the character at the position of your cursor, and so I'm going to delete the M I just inserted, and then on the other side, I receive insert character M at the position of my cursor, and so I'm going to insert an M here, and I get inconsistent state after everything has been received and processed. So we have a problem. So, the idea of operational transform is to say, well, one solution to this would be to say, well, you know, this was wrong because when I inserted the M, your cursor moved back here because it was just sort of an index, it's like the sixth character or something. Now, I should know better, and I know that if I insert something, I should push all the cursors that are after me by one character as well, so it still stays between the W and the O here. Here, when I erase the W, well, if I erase the W, the cursor, the green cursor should stay here. So if I do this, which is to, in a sense, update the cursor position so they stay consistent, I could converge to a consistent situation where one person has erased the W, the other has inserted the M, so we all end up with the same situation. And people have tried to do this, but it didn't quite work because there are always very tricky cases, in particular when cursors are at the same position. Because when they are in the same position, what do you do? I mean, are they really at the same position, or is one a little bit after the other? And so there are situations where you would not converge to a consistent state. So, what operational transform does is, again, it uses Landborg timestamps for a total ordering of the operations. When it arrives late, instead of doing the undo redo, it's looking at the history buffer, says, well, it should have happened there, in the history buffer. Let's see how to transform this operation so it has the same effect by executing it now instead of after having undone everything. So it's going to go through the history buffer one operation at a time, one event at a time, and for each pair of operation, there is a transformation function that says that if operation 1 has to be swapped with operation 2, then I have to transform operation 2 into operation prime 2, so that executing operation prime 2 over a text where operation 1 has been executed first is the same as if I executed operation 1 after operation 2. Right? Make sense?
Wait, can we do an example?
I'll try. So, the key here is that when two
I think I have an example on the next slide. Yes, so we'll get there.
So, when an operation arrives, I transform it by all those that occurred after it, and then I execute the resulting operation. And if the transformations are right, executing this transform operation now has the same effect as if I had received it in time and done it at the time where it was issued.
So what do these transformation operations look like?
So imagine that I receive insert P1 at position P1 the character C1 from site S1, and yes, so okay, so I received insert P1 at and in my history buffer, I have insert P2 that has happened after. I haven't yet executed the insert P1, so the effect of this has not been taken into account. Now, if I was inserting P1, if position 1 was before position 2, that's the case I illustrated where I insert and have to push what was behind. So, if P1 was, I think this is the reverse, because I'm sorry. I tried to rehearse this, but I guess we'll have to do an illustration. So I have my text, this is P1, this is position 2, and so I have inserted the character here, and I want to insert the character here. The point is that The thing I never remember is which one is transformed by which. That's why I'm confused. I think P1 has been inserted and I received P2. P2 happened temporarily before P1, but if P2 is after P1, it doesn't matter. If it's the opposite, if P2 is before P1, well, here, you see what it says here, is that if P1 is before P2 or equal, but so that's the total ordering thing, then I insert at the same position, and in the other case, I insert one slot later. So I want to insert at P1 plus 1 when I have inserted P2 before.
So we are transforming P1.
Yeah, so we are transforming P1, exactly. Okay, so I think I got it. So I had a text here, and at position P2, I inserted a character. I receive P1 now, but I know it happened before this operation was executed. But the position P1 is after in the text. Now, because I received this late, I have to take into account that something was inserted at P2. And so my position P1, the number of characters in the beginning of the text to here, is wrong because I have since inserted a character here. So I have to move my insert by one character to have the right effect. Okay? Now, this tells you that writing this transformation operation is messy. In fact, this is something that I find fascinating, is there was a paper, I've put the reference to it, it was done by French researchers, in fact, who used theorem proving to look at all these algorithms. And that was a paper, I think, in the mid-90s. And they showed that every algorithm that had been published until then, they were all buggy. There were all situations where this didn't work. And you find in the CSW conference in particular, which took place every 2 years, now it's every year, there is always one or two papers about operational transform. It's very hard to read and to understand and to check that it is correct. And I'm sure a lot of these are in fact incorrect because they are very tricky cases. So here I showed for something as simple as inserting a character, when you look at the complete set of transformations you have to deal for a simple text editor, it becomes really, really complicated. And you have to do every pair of operations. So you have n different operations. I have n square transformation operations to create. And so, to me, this is a case where the cost, not only computational, but the intellectual cost of building these algorithms, to me, doesn't seem worth the trouble compared to a straight undo redo or to the simple optimizations that I talked about. And my impression is that a few people have done a lot of work on this, but in the end, I don't think it's really the approach that makes sense. Because so many of these things are wrong that you cannot trust it. So I think by now, for simple text editing, we have the right set of transformation functions that work. But it is a very tricky thing, and if you look at papers, you'll find that. And this is something you find in distributed systems in general. Is you have these diagrams. I probably should have used them here because was not good at explaining how it works. But you have these diagrams, these time diagrams, that show you, well, you know, this event is sent and received there, and this happens. But very quickly, you have this exponential explosion of possibilities. Most of the papers look at two sites, but what happens if you have 3, 10, 100 sites? You know, the combinatorial explosion is mind-boggling, and you have to convince yourself that it works in all these cases. Also, the problem you run into very quickly is when you have conflicts, which is when these transformations apply, in some cases it's clear what the right result is, but in some cases it's not clear. And so there's been a lot of papers that have played with this notion of causality preservation versus, intention preservation. And intention preservation is what it is that the user wanted to do. What was the intention of the user? And sometimes you have algorithms that have the right properties and all that, but when you use them, you realize, well, but this is not really what I wanted to do. And so, to summarize in this, running the transformations is hard, and proving that they work is even harder. And as I said, a lot of them actually don't really work in all cases. This is based on the notion of preserving causality, where causality is defined as, in general, if an operation happened after another one, then operation the later is causally dependent on the earlier one. But that's a very much too strong definition of causality. So people have tried to make that softer, but then you run into things that don't match intention preservation. And all algorithms have this property of convergence, that when things quiet down, everything's been processed, they do converge to the same result. But it may not be the result you had in mind. And so that's quite frustrating. So Google Doc uses operation of a transform. In JavaScript, there's a library called ShareJS that uses that as well. And so there are tools now where you can create shared editors without having to create the transforms yourself, which is a good thing. Okay, well, I think we're going to take a break. I'll show quickly a few groupware toolkits that have been built over the years, and then we'll talk about the project I would like you to work on and the papers. Okay? Do you have any questions about this? Well, it's the goal here was to give you a sense of, you know, the fact that it is complicated, the type of solutions that are out there. I don't expect you to fully understand how it works. I'm not going to trick you in the exam to, you know, write, transform, and things like this. It's just to get a feeling that quickly you get into very serious computer science problems. So if I did that, at least this one step.
So basically, the current solutions don't scale to regarding software. We don't have a solution for making a large software.
No, you don't have a universal solution. And I don't think a universal solution exists. And I don't think it exists in general. I mean, if you look at even algorithms for sorting or for doing basic things, they always depend on some assumptions about what you're using them for. So I think here, you know, I don't expect to have a universal solution that covers any type of shared editing, you know, with any type of constraints on the network. a number of these algorithms make assumption about the transport, that everything that is sent arrives, or that everything that is sent arrives in order, and things like this. When you scale things up, like multiplayer games and things like this, have more real-time constraints. So they have situations where you want to make sure that what you send arrives quickly, even if it means that it may get lost. So if you use UDP instead of TCP, it's okay that you lose packets. If you're watching a video, for example, or if you're playing music, it's better to drop frames than to try to have every frame arrive and have to wait for it to arrive. So because the application constraints can be very different from one tool to the next, I don't think it makes even sense to look for a general solution that works all the time. We have pretty good solutions that work for different categories of things.
Yeah, but there could be a theoretical solution that
would work for
it
everything.
It must be. I can't even believe that there's not a solution for that problem. It seems easy.
The world is yours.
I mean, but...
Solve it and become famous. No, it's...
I don't know, it's... Naive.
Well, but if you look at what's been done for databases, transformations, transactions in databases, this is a really dumb solution. I mean, it works because it's really stupid and inefficient. I mean, here we are already trying to have the cake and eat it at the same time by saying, well, time doesn't count. I want things happening immediately on my machine and later on other machines and still everything be consistent all the time. So I think that we can show theoretically that some things are impossible. So what we're trying to do is to make it, the least inconvenient as possible for things that, there's no, if I have not received your character, I cannot have it on my computer. As you were saying, if I'm editing an object that then happens to have been deleted by someone else a few seconds before, my changes are going to get lost. And that's where we're getting from this notion of causality, which is really the sort of bread and butter of distributed systems. And I've talked to people who are very good researchers in distributed systems, and they all agree that this notion of causality that they're using is much too strong than what applications really need. But they don't want to have applications give them more subtle requirements. And so when we're talking about intention preservation instead of causality preservation, we're going from this very strong rules of causality as seen by the system to sort of more softer and less well-defined rules of, oh, but this is what I think should happen when we're doing this simultaneously, but in this other context it should be something different. So capturing these rules is hard. And even if you do that, then turning it into an algorithm that works is difficult. I've put a couple of papers on the web page, and I can give you more references. A number of seriously smart people have worked on this. So, Google Docs works. So for small subsets of operations that are well understood, we know how to make it work. I would love to have a general solution. So as I said, the world is yours, and become famous by solving this. And you can make a big business. I mean, it's not just a research issue.
Yeah, we don't have a solution to generate those transformations automatically, because they are tricky to write.
Yes.
But
not that I know.
Make a software to generate them, so it would solve the problem.
Not that that I know because I think we don't have a good way to capture really the semantics. I think a big mistake. The reason we have all these complications and this has been applied mostly to text editing, is because the position, the operations are encoded with, you know, insert this character at this position in the text. And it always felt to me like this is wrong. Because of course the index in the text changes according to what the others are doing.
So you mean it should be inserted before this word?
Well, not even that, because the words change, but why don't you have a model of text where you have characters and you have marks? Markers, cursors, whatever you want to call them. So that I put a mark here, and if I insert stuff before, the mark moves, it stays where it is. So why not treat the cursor or the positions at which you make operations objects themselves? Because then you can say, well, move that cursor right or left, or insert something at that cursor. And you don't have to deal with this position as offsets that constantly change. The problem, and I've tried to do this, so the problem you run into is when, as long as the cursors stay away from each other and don't cross each other, you're mostly fine. But I quickly run into problems when the cursor are at the same position, because you need to know which one is. You still need an order when they're at each position, and you could use the order of sides to say, you know, my cursor is always going to be, you know, in front of the others or something. But then there were also situations where you say, you know, this cursor is here, this one is here. Move this by 10 characters. You still need with distances in text that may change according to what others are doing. And so I think there's something to be done there, quite frankly. I shifted to other topics in my research and work on that. But I really think that the way it's addressed now with these operational transforms is not the right way to do it. There must be a simpler way where the semantics of it are easier to understand. So you had a question? You had a question. I think she was first.
Yeah.
Well, this is sort of what I was implying there, where the position of the other cursors would be objects in the text,
yeah.
And so I can triangle. But even if you do that, if you move your cursor, say, the thing is, then you have to have a much richer set of operations, because if you move your cursor to the end of the word, by doing a set of forward by one character, but at the same time someone has inserted a new character in that word, the system won't know you were going to the end of the word, right? So if I have a richer set of operations and users use them, and you do say, well, go to the end of the word, then I can make it happen even if someone has inserted stuff inside this word. Although if someone inserts a space, what is the end of the word? So you see that the set of operations we have on text is, on the one hand, very low level, but from our perspective, we give it very higher level meaning, like I've gone to the, you know, to the end of this, or and so I think it's because there's this mismatch between what the system sees we're doing, which is moving a cursor, inserting, deleting, and what operations are in our mind, which are higher level editing operations. And if we don't reconcile this, I think we'll be stuck with approach.
Is it an important principle to lead the user to do whatever he wants, even if it makes no sense?
That's in general, we try to let the user be in control.
Yes, sometimes they need some control because they do things that have no meaning for the system.
Well, you know, there was so when you're editing text, like, you know, a report or something, it's text, so. But there's been a lot of work on editing programs, source code, using what was called syntax-oriented systems, where the system would not let you create something that was not a syntactically correct piece of code. So you could not write if the system, you say, well, I want an if then else here, you insert it all for you, and then you have to fill in the blanks and all that. And people tried this for many years when I started as a researcher. I remember there were several systems that were trying to do that. It was a pain to use because we don't think this way, and the UIs were not well designed. So when you edit code, for example, just to take that example, you have a lot of the time your code is inconsistent, syntactically incorrect. Not talking about semantically incorrect. I mean, the system would not let you insert a variable that you had not declared, and things like this. But that required you to think like the computer, in a sense. Whereas when you program, you know, you keep things in your head, and you want to have a consistent state. So I think, yes, you have to let the users do crazy things from the perspective of the system. Because it's part of a bigger task that will eventually converge. I don't know, but I mean, I agree with you. It's strange we haven't really solved this problem, but when you dig into it, you realize it's a lot more to it than you think at first. So, any other question?
I was about to say the same thing about. I think all this algorithm use the character as the way to communicate. Maybe it's not the right granularity. Maybe word could be a better separation, maybe paragraph, because we are trying to separate one word between two persons, and maybe that is not the common use for that. That was one thing. And the other is relational databases now are leaving away the concept of transaction. There are a lot of buzz around the concept of NoSQL, and also for parallel programming, they are using semaphores or forks. That is not the way to program. That thing is horrible. It's understandable.
Yeah.
So,
things are changing. I think for text editing, I think people have tried to have higher level operations, but I don't know if it's because we're used to editing at the character level, or we haven't found yet the right sort of interactions to edit at higher levels, but it doesn't work. Things that work, in fact, not too badly, is with this cooperative aspect. They say, well, the hell with all these conflicts. We'll make implicit locking at the level of line, for example. And so if I'm editing something, nobody else can edit in that line, and so then you solve 95% of the problems. Maybe at the word level.
Because it makes no sense to edit different characters at the same time in segments.
Well, you know,
with a wrong word.
It doesn't. I mean, I found myself using Google Docs, for example, in a situation where sometimes you work really on the same word but on different tasks. So, you know, I remember there was one occurrence where
maybe SQL.
No, not SQL, but you know, someone fixing typos while another person is doing something else. I mean, we're back to this notion of higher level tasks. And sometimes higher level tasks can, in terms of individual edits, come very close to each other without really the users getting in the way of each other. So, I don't know. I mean, I think there are things to be explored in this area.
Because if you show on the screen that this one is locked, the other user won't try to edit.
Yeah. And that's why I think the clouds that they talk about in the Grove paper, although I can't in fact find if it were actually implemented, I think are a good idea. I think that the giving better feed through about what you are doing would be good, and
there is a completely separate area in the HCI when there were people working on activity-centric computing, where the idea is that you explicitly create in the system the notion of activities, and you say, well, you know, when I'm working on this activity, which is to work on this project, I need these files, and I need these tools, and I need these things. And so you can shift from one activity to the next, and when the system detects that, it can bring all the resources for this activity. And so it's trying to sort of get and to reflect in the system itself the fact that we actually work at, you know, higher level tasks than just the low level editing and mousing around. I'm sorry?
They try to make the computer think like machine learning.
Well, that's where things get a little bit... because there's this fine line between trying to second-guess the user, and so a lot of people are also trying to do that, and I think in general the computer loses this game, guessing what the user really wants to do. So I prefer to view it as, you know, well, the system, you know, it'd be nice if it could notice that every time I'm working on that computer, I'm also on that file, I'm also using this tool or just other things.
It's a bit convenient, but
and
not forcing you to.
Right, yeah. So it should leave me in control, but I not necessarily want it to do things for me. And so I think if we get a better way to explicitly represent what we're doing at this high level task level, it could certainly help at the lower levels, but it's yeah it's not easy to because there's always this cost of, you know, capturing more information from the user is only going to work if the user finds that useful, right? Because you're asking the user to do more things, so you need to have a bigger return on investment for this to work.
And go to Caroline.
I know. Okay, shall we take a short break? Stand together, so let's make it 10 minutes so we can start in 15.